The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome to Ask an Atheist. We are a weekly educational call-in program where you get to ask a rotating cast of atheists and humanists, skeptics, other kinds of freethinkers, any of your questions. We, like I said, are a call-in program, so please, if you have any questions for this group of atheists, the number is 253-584-1480. My name is Becky, and with me today are Chad and Rich. How are you guys doing?
Splendid.
Awesome.
Awesome, awesome. Well, let's get us started today. It's did you know that it's 111 days till the backpedaling begins?
111 days.
Yes, 111 days. As our regular listeners may know, a loose affiliation of Christians are declaring that in 110 days, Jesus Christ will return to this earth and will end the world as we know it 6 months thereafter. And have you heard of these billboards and ads that have been going up around the U.S. and even outside of the U.S. now?
Yeah, I already sold my house.
I would totally like to catch one of these guys who really believes it and buy his house.
I don't know how cheap they're selling them for, but we at Ask an Atheist have got a little counter for that. We've got a counter proposal, as the Christians have it, and they confidently declare we can know. We have at Ask an Atheist wecantknow.com, where we have a little time counter counting down to not May 21st when they purport that Jesus is supposed to return, but May 22nd when we believe that the backpedaling will need to begin, the excuse making,
the spin, the start,
and the rebooting of life for so many.
Yes.
exactly.
Whoops.
So please do check us out, our listeners, at wecantknow.com for some fun things. We have a few emails that we'd like to get started with. Our first email today is from Ricky. We believe you're from Massachusetts, Ricky. Just if anyone emails us, you can always go to askanatheist.tv, click on the big red button that says Ask a Question, and submit an email that way to us. Please let us know where you're emailing from. We always like to know where our listeners and viewers are calling from and emailing us from. But Ricky from Massachusetts writes, I just listened to yesterday's show. This was about 2 weeks ago. I would like to say that I didn't realize you had a former member of the UPCI, a former pastor, no less, as part of your show. Rich, tell us about UPCI.
UPCI is a code word for cult. No, actually, I actually identify them as a cult, and you can actually Google on the radio or on the internet.
Fantastic. Radio's become magic.
Yeah. You can actually Google it and the word UPCI and cult and come up with tens of thousands of hits. It's a United Pentecostal Church International. It's a church group, but they have very exclusive views, very exclusive, and that is the group that I was a pastor for.
And you, Rich, are indeed the person that this viewer and listener is referring to. So Ricky says, I was raised in the UPC and my immediate family still believes it strongly. My mother actually bought a television a couple of years ago, but it's mostly to watch Fox News on.
You see, that's one of the things. Having a television in your home was considered a sin and you would go to hell for that. For owning a television, I went 20 years, didn't watch a TV show, did not go to a movie, didn't listen to secular radio, even though I was working in secular radio for part of that time. So it was that's how you control people's mind. If you control what they read, what they listen to, what they watch, what they see, if you control all of that, you pretty well can control the individual.
Control input, control output.
Exactly.
So Ricky's mom has loosened up a bit then in
terms
of getting
the United Pentecostal Church actually is loosening up. Kind of, they're allowing people to watch DVDs, and depending on what church you go to, you can actually have a television in your home now. So they're loosening up because they realize that you can't control everything.
Got it. Well, Ricky continues, coming out of the UPC gives us one heck of an advantage once the emotional scars are gone. that is, because nobody knows their Bible better than we do.
Exactly.
My mother always said there was nothing worse than a backslider armed with the Word of God, which Ricky puts in quotes.
Yes.
And I never really understood that until I began debating Christians as an atheist. Ricky congratulates us on our move to radio and says that he loves our show. So I as someone who didn't grow up Pentecostal, but grew up as someone who was very literate in the Hebrew scriptures, found that even when I was a practicing Jew, I always was able to quote my Old Testament a little bit better than some of the Christians that were maybe trying to get me to come over to Jesus.
The first thing I like to do when a Christian starts in on me, you know, they always have this arrogant assumption that they know one thing about it that I didn't know. I was a pastor for 20 years. I mean, yeah, right. You know, they'll say something. But to me, the first thing I like to say is, how many times have you read that book in your hand from cover to cover? I've read it 13 times cover to cover, studied it for a minimum of 3 hours a day for 20 years, in addition to the 13 times cover to cover. Do you really think you've got something in there that I don't know? I mean, chances are you don't. And so he's right about that. When that is one thing the UPC does is emphasizes the Bible, Bible, Bible. And that, in my opinion now, is probably the best way to become an atheist once you realize how inconsistent it is and how things really don't add up.
The Bible is glorious. I love sparring with – I don't usually do much of the – I'm going to argue with you about your religion and your religious beliefs sort of thing. But when I see somebody acting in a really terrible way – with religious justification, you know, I can always spar with them on their own turf, so to speak, and say, well, what about this? You know what I mean? I mean, this is from a guy who doesn't even believe any of that. And you know, sometimes
of course, your background is Jehovah's Witness. They read a lot of Bible
I'm pretty schooled. You know, I can't really regurgitate as well as I used to, mostly because I've just tried to forget that part of my life.
Yeah. Well, when you put other reading materials in your brain, then some of the older ones that you're familiar with kind of, you know, take a back seat. So yeah. I'm sure glad now that, Chad, you can recall some of your other more recent readings.
Yeah, I'm a little more concerned with jazz guitar voicings now. you know, it's a different life. Better.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. Thank you, Ricky.
You very much, Ricky, and congratulations on your journey out. Would love to talk to you. Send them an email. Or if they could send me an email. So I'd love to correspond with you and just swap stories and learn a little about you.
Absolutely. Our next email comes from RJ from Georgia. And RJ actually has two questions embedded in this email. The first question is, how do we respond to people that say, God lifted me up when I was in a very dark place, or something of that nature? I'm not sure if RJ is a man or a woman, but, Rich, why don't you take this one? Because you, I think, as a former pastor, had a lot of times where you encouraged people to let God lift them up out of a dark place.
Exactly. And one thing I noticed in 20 years of pastoring is people who were good at pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, generally those were the ones God lifted out of difficult places.
Imagine that.
And the people who really just kind of fell and wallowed in their stuff. That's a Southern word, wallard. God just kind of wallered them. He enwallerinated them. He empowered them to waller. It just kind of seemed to me that God empowered people to do exactly what they would have done if he hadn't been there. And then I realized he isn't there. Anytime God, quote, lifts someone out of a dark situation, they did it themselves. It's just like Daniel Dennett talks about in Breaking the Spell. Would it be a good thing to go to people who had been delivered from Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, through that program, delivered from alcoholism, and go to them and tell them there is no God, there is no higher power? On the surface, you might think these people would just go straight to the gutter and become alcoholics. But if you tell them, no, wait a minute, all of this hard stuff that you've been through, you did yourself. You are the higher power who did that. You are the person who overcame alcoholism. Imagine the power that gives that person. Imagine when they realize, if I'm bigger than alcoholism, if I'm stronger than alcoholism, what else am I stronger than? You totally empower them. So the true sad thing about this is when they say, God lifted me out of this, what they're doing is not taking credit, number one, for what they and probably people in their community helped them accomplish. But they're probably the same people who, whenever something goes wrong, blames themselves and says, somehow I've let down God and this is why this happened. So you've created kind of a dichotomy, a self-defeating dichotomy. Anything good happens, it was God. Anything bad happens, It was me. So what do I tell those people? It's great that you were able to overcome this situation. And imagine with the power you've gained, with the strength you've gained, knowing you can overcome that. Imagine what else you can overcome and how you can use that to help other people.
Life is so much better without emotional payoff multipliers.
Isn't it?
Really.
I like that. Emotional payoff multipliers. That's good.
You know, a lot less, you know, just watch, if you're not a fan of soap operas, you don't do that kind of thing. Just watch maybe a day of them straight.
Mm-hmm.
See how you feel afterwards.
I don't think I'll take you up on that, no. Chad. Okay. But I will take up RJ on the next question that he or she poses. What are good ideas for meeting atheist ladies rather than just random luck? Christians seem to get together at church, and that's even where my friends suggest to get a nice girl, but I've been down that road before and it doesn't end well. Each of us being atheists, we all have partners, boyfriends, girlfriends, or spouses at this point. Chad, where did you meet your beloved?
I met Michelle. We've been together for a little more than a year, and life is glorious. And I met her at Doyle's at a Tacoma Atheist Meetup. There are official kind of groups, mostly social, some sort of activist, part of the ever-growing atheist visibility movement that's been happening for the last few years. People of all kinds get together. So the best thing you can do is just build a really awesome social life centered around your interests.
So what is this meetup that you're talking about? Is this something that people do phone trees or emails about? How do you sort of get involved in that? How do you find a meetup near your area of atheists that
there
like
is,
to get together?
There are probably other websites like it, but there is a meetup, a website called meetup.com where organizers can pay an annual fee that's very nominal to create a group of people that hang out for a specific purpose. There are the motorcycle maintenance meetups. There are the I ride a bicycle everywhere meetups, and there are the let's try to use Oprah's version of the law of attraction to get rich meetups. Anything
so there's
you can
something
think
there for everyone?
Exactly. So go to meetup.com and search for secularism, atheism, free thinkers, whatever little science fiction. I don't know how much luck you'll get scoring at a sci-fi con, but it all depends, but just branch out, meet people for cool reasons. You'll stumble upon somebody. But one of the best, unrelated to atheism and stuff, but one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was just build a really, really awesome single life with a lot of people in it that are really cool.
And you pretty much have to do that anyway, because coming out of a religion, they're going to shun you.
Exactly.
So you're going to have to reboot your whole social environment anyway.
Yeah, for the deconverted, it may be even actually a little easier. Yeah, I didn't actually spend any time personally thinking about dating in and of itself. I didn't spend any time dating. I just stumbled upon somebody. And it may seem like pure luck, but it's actually not. It's sort of a passive benefit of just living your life and growing as a person.
Exactly.
I think one more thing for our college age listeners, a lot of campuses are now having secular student unions or free thought organizations that are that have a professor that's an advisor. There's a national organization or one that works in the U.S. and in Canada as well that helps start up these organizations on your campus. So if you are a college going student or if you're nearby a college, oftentimes campus organizations will welcome people from the community in as well.
Is that called the Secular Student Alliance?
I believe Secular Student Alliance is the...
Don't quote us on that. But
is the umbrella organization.
Try a quick Google search and you should be able to find some cool stuff.
One of the things, the question here kind of begs for me, it says to find a nice girl. And one of the first things I realized, I didn't want a nice girl. I mean, when you look
Same
by the Christian
here.
Standard of a nice girl... chances are that may not really be who you're looking for anyway.
So did you find a not-so-nice girl, Rich?
I found a naughty girl.
As I might say, nice.
The most wonderful girl ever. And the way I found her, strangely enough, we worked together and had talked on the phone several times. We became Facebook friends, and she saw on Facebook that I was always out having it. Like, as Chad said, I created a life of my own. I was having my fun. Everywhere I go, I have fun and just kind of reflected that, and she realized this guy must be having a lot of fun. I noticed on her Facebook profile that she was a atheist and free thinker, and said, "Hey, we need to get together." And as they say, it's history from there.
So maybe RJ, you can make sure to publicize the fact that you're an atheist, and maybe some other folks will be in that search as well. The other thing, finally, is if I'm a maybe nice girl, half naughty, half nice, I've been found by somebody. And when I first got together with my partner, Sam, who is one of the producers of the show, and you may see him in archive footage and archived shows, I wasn't out as an atheist. I wasn't out to myself as an atheist at that point. We'll talk about, as we progress through the show, sort of our journeys away from faith between the three of us. But mine involved, some different kinds of exposure to different kinds of belief systems, and those without God or without an organized religious community. So, RJ, you can always sort of go for the fence sitters and see if she reasons through it and maybe joins you in your atheistic leanings.
Practice your cackle. You know, there's a lot of them. So
I didn't practice.
Find your favorite.
So
there's a meetup, actually.
Yeah. So those are our emails. Again, if you would like to email us any questions that we may address on air, you can go to askanatheist.tv, push the big red button, and ask us a question. We'll be back in a few moments with some more things about how Rich, Chad, and I have come out of faith and what living afterwards is like. Hi, welcome back to Ask an Atheist. We are a call-in show, so if you'd like to give us a call, 253-584-1480. Our topic today, between myself, Rebecca, and Rich, and Chad, is living after faith. Those of us who came from religious households. We're a little bit different from some of the usual characters that you hear on Ask an Atheist, who grew up in secular or agnostic households. But just because the three of us grew up in different households, and just because our listeners may have grown up in religious households, does not mean that we all had the same kind of experience.
Absolutely.
And so we'd love to hear from you, and we're going to hopefully share a little bit of our own stories. But before we get into our own stories, we have a caller, Robert, from Huntsville, Alabama. Your struggles about being Christian prior to becoming an atheist now. Robert, are you with us?
I'm here.
Hi, Robert.
Hey, what's up, man?
I'm doing pretty good. I've called in a couple of times before, and I don't think I've ever spoken to any of you. Now, before we go on, first off, I'm a human being who has theistic beliefs. And your show is actually one of those that started me saying that, because I've actually gotten tired of people who says, well, I'm Christian, I'm this. You know, you guys have kind of like started me saying, well, I'm a human being before anything else, but my beliefs may be theistic, but that doesn't stop us all from the great equality of being human beings.
I'm digging that.
Absolutely. Yeah. As someone who ascribes to the humanist philosophies, there's nothing that says in a humanist philosophy that separates a theist from an atheist except for the belief systems, but in their innate quality as a human being and as a worthy human being and someone that's capable of self-determination and worth, that is one of the uniting factors of all of us, no matter what we believe.
I fully agree. What I wanted to ask was each of you individually now, because you're talking about coming out of faith, specifically from a Christian faith, and more generally, I guess, religion in general.
Right.
One thing I was going to ask, because I've had similar experience, whereas I won't say I was ever a Christian never chose to be a Christian up until my mid-20s. Before then, I was always taken to different churches and things like that, and eventually, due to certain teachings they had of the Southern Baptist variety, said, you know what, I'm just leaving the church. You know, I'm leaving this thing. I don't know what to believe. Now, I have come into a Greek Orthodox point of view, but I've learned that all my old friends, even though I am still a Christian, they refuse to acknowledge me as that. And I've, you know, a lot of people I used to associate with refuse to do that, even though we, quote-unquote, believe in the same God.
Exactly. I totally understand where you are there. As a former Pentecostal, we did not consider other Christians to be Christians. We were the true, and everybody else was false. So even though you would have been moved from Pentecost to something else, you are now a backslider. You're anathema. We cut you off. We separate from you.
Yeah, same Jehovah's Witnesses are the same way.
Yeah. So, yeah, we totally understand. Go ahead.
Well, now, you actually mentioned a term I was going to bring up. You used the term backslider. I find this a lot with the once saved, always saved mentality, that once you say the magic spell of, I now ask Jesus into my heart, I'm going to heaven, you know, which I always find interesting that these people hate paganism, and yet they're doing magic spells just like pagans do.
Touche.
Indeed.
Not to insult pagans, it's just, you know, a lot of the fundamentalist Christians, you know, want to down them. I love the comparison. But that being, now that you just totally don't accept it, for those of you who came from the once saved, always saved, do they still say, will they say, oh, you never really were saved, that you weren't really converted? Or do they say, oh, you're still going to heaven, but you're still making mistakes? I mean,
you just centered on both of the answers they'll give. Some will say, you never actually were saved, which that begs the question, okay, how do I know? And then they'll say, well, you have to accept it by faith. And you say, oh, but I accepted it by faith, but now you're telling me I'm not. So you get into this paradox of youcantknow.com. you get into this paradox of saying you never know if you're saved. But on the other hand, they're saying, be totally secure in your salvation. So you get into a paradox within their own doctrine. You get into this either way you go, because you can't possibly be doing the things you're doing and still be saved. So obviously you couldn't have been saved to start with. So you must not have been sincere when you accepted.
Now, it depends, Robert, on how they want to treat you, basically.
Yeah, and now, Robert, I come from a Jewish background, and Jews do not have the same kind of investment in being saved once you accept, the teachings into your heart in the same way. And I think an ironic way of sort of dealing with that is that every year when we have our Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, Jews will do what's called make teshuvah, which means return. And it's something that happens communally every year where you have to sort of get re-saved, if you will, but within a Jewish context. I guess maybe for Jews, we assume that we're going to backslide every year, and so every year we got to renew that. I'm not sure.
You know, that's reality-based, if nothing else.
So I think that every tradition and every sort of community has a different way of reconciling that, whether you are saved, whether you're a true believer, whether you're, you know, going against the grain, against the faith.
And Robert, as somebody with theistic beliefs, do you notice that element in your relationship with religion and stuff? I mean, do you kind of have a similar thing, whether you quantify it or not?
As far as salvation itself?
And just kind of like, you know, trying to refresh and come back to it and backsliding. Where do you ever cross the line where that kind of rhetoric, you've mentioned going to trying a couple different religions. I don't know, just kind of picking your brain about that whole dynamic.
I wasn't really trying different religions. I just, when I was younger, I was born to a Roman Catholic household, but I never really ascribed to the beliefs because, I'm sorry, when you're, you know, 7, 8, 9, you're not spouting what you believe. You're spouting what other people tell you to believe.
Yeah.
Right. And then my parents started going, jumping churches and things like that, all sorts of different things. Eventually, when I think I was 13, we started going to Southern Baptist. And, you know, I spouted the rhetoric, but I never really accepted what they said, because what they said, well, the Bible doesn't have contradictions. And I actually got in trouble for saying, but what about the last words of Christ? That's a contradiction, isn't it? Because it's three different – everything. He's saying these are the three last words. What about how the creation story? There's two different ones.
I think many of us here have, and many of our listeners have also experienced getting in a little bit of trouble finding those contradictions and asking our elders about it.
Yeah, and so I ended up just leaving it after a while, just saying, you know what, guys, I've almost died. You guys, just either I'm like you or I'm not. Of course, I was always the sci-fi kid, where everybody else was the sports. And since I didn't fit in anyway, they just kind of ignored me. And so I went around, and eventually I met my wife through a group called the SDA. And I was going to say, for that gentleman who's asking for finding, I don't know what he's into, but anything that just hobby interest, like the SDA, Society of Christian Acronyms, great place to meet people who don't base everything on religion. I found it's a lot of atheists do go to those things like that, but that's beside the point. Anyway, and ended up finding what's called Greek Orthodoxy, and studying the faith, studying their teachings and things like that, and coming to that, you know, like, I really do believe this, because there's still some personal experiences that is not scientific, nor I can use to convince anyone, but it's a personal experience that has helped me. I accept that there is a deity of some sort. Now, I fully accept I could be 100% wrong. I don't mind saying that.
It sounds like you're, and I think I remember you from a past episode when you called in. It sounds like that you are an agnostic theist, someone who acknowledges that, you know, there may be no way of knowing necessarily, but you have a belief that you stand by.
Oh, no, I'm not going to say there may not be. I'm saying there is absolutely no way of knowing. I mean, I fully admit I could be 100% wrong. You know, I have no problem saying that because, even I said, faith isn't something that can be proven outside of a personal experience, but personal experience does not equate into evidence, if you understand what I mean. I don't know if
absolutely.
I'm using the correct words.
Yeah, no, it sounds...
that's the right word.
Yep.
Yeah, so while I may be convinced, I still admit I could be wrong.
I think that's kind of the heart of a free thinker is admitting you might be wrong, and because that opens the door for more evidence or less evidence as it may be given.
Intellectual honesty.
Yeah, and your position can change. I'm not out trying to convert people to atheism or deconvert because I could be wrong. I spent 20 years of my life in what I now admit is a cult and as a leader of that, and I was wrong. And I fully admit I could be just as wrong now as I could have been, as I absolutely was then.
Given the topic, too, today's topic, you know, I appreciate that you called in, you know, because, you touched on your experiences going from one religion to another and kind of like the social aspects and stuff. And it is true that we can focus on those common experiences and kind of learn from that and learn from each other.
Well, now, you did ask me a question I do want to answer as far as, you know, my idea of salvation and sin and things like that. Within our beliefs, and my personal one, is everybody sins. Regardless, there's no such thing as a non-sinner, and that just means doing wrong, even outside of a Christian context. Just doing something that, you know, humanity would consider wrong or evil, things like that to varying degrees, which is something that, in my personal belief, is I try to do what's right and follow my heart. And, you know, when I do feel regret, I try and just make atonement for that, you know. And it's not just saying, oh, Lord, forgive me, forgive me, forgive me. Because true regret isn't fear of punishment. Just like I'm not a Christian because I fear hell. In fact, the people who use hell as, oh, do this or go to hell, do this or go to hell, have brainwashed sheep that just want to follow them because they're not sincere. They're doing things out of fear. And how can you really repent? Because if you repent and you feel bad something, you feel bad even though you're going to get away with it, if you understand. And as far as salvation is concerned, I just live my life to the best of my ability, try to help people without reward to the best of my ability,
well, I think
and
that,
just leave it up to my deity.
I think that you'll probably find a lot of common ground with atheists and humanists that essentially leave that kind of self-determination of what to do that's right and wrong. I would think that the big difference is atheists tend not to use terms like sin or atonement because of the
or salvation.
Or salvation, for that matter, yeah, because of the loaded nature of those terms.
Emotional multipliers.
Yeah, how much religious connotation they carry in our culture. As you said, independent of a Christian context, a sin may be something that you do wrong, that humans think, you know, is hurtful or harmful. But the word sin really does, denote some kind of Judeo-Christian context.
Right.
On my way out of being religious, I adopted a similar thing. When I decided to become an atheist and entertain that idea, I did it for the direct purpose of becoming a better person, because I thought that my beliefs were holding me back in certain ways that I kind of identified. And it was a long thought process and a huge thing. But I at first I wasn't ready to give up the idea that there was a God, but I needed to think this way and I needed to act this way. So I decided to trust this, you know, this character to just see, to know better than all the people that were judging me. And see why I do what I do every day, because I've never not wanted to be a good person. So, yeah, we have that in common, you know. It's a good thing.
And that's something I agree with. And like I said, because I am a theist, I use those terms. And, of course, they cover in a lot of the what is essentially Christian characteristics. In fact, this comes into a last time I called, we touched on this as far as when you're speaking to someone, especially when it's like from atheist to Christian, especially somebody who follows Muslim or something else, when we start using language, you have to take time to define exactly what you're speaking on, because not everybody will ascribe to the same thing, or the same word may not mean the exact same thing.
Yeah, and Robert, one of the things that I'm finding is that in a lot of your values that you're espousing is something that's really common to humanism, and it may be found in many different religions, but it's something that atheists and people of all different kinds of persuasions can ascribe to, in terms of you know, being kind and helping one another and avoiding harm. And Robert, we do thank you for your call so much. It's really nice to have you listening and listening
stuff.
Consistently.
Yeah.
We want to make room for some other calls. So if you would like to call and ask us some questions, our number is 253-584-1480. And again, this is Ask an Atheist. Rich, you as a former pastor had a really different journey than a lot of people coming out of faith. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of the context for what you, you did tell us about sort of existing in that cult, as you have come to recognize it as, but can you tell us a little bit about that process of transition and what life is like now?
The process of transition was kind of difficult. As a pastor, you're invested in it. I mean, that was my career. That was how I made my income. My entire social circle, everything was the church. That's all there was in my life. And that's kind of typical of a cult, is that's what they build you into, where the cult is all of your life. So at that point, you know, everything in life was developed around this. There was an incident that came up in the church, and I'll make it as brief as I can. We thought that our church had been exposed to the SARS virus. And you can actually Google it on the internet, Lufkin, Texas, SARS. I was actually in Marshall, Texas, but the group that sang at our church was from Lufkin, Texas. And you'll see mentioned there, Lighthouse United Pentecostal Church. That was the church I was a pastor of. And that church, we thought, had been exposed to SARS. Center for Disease Control contacted us. They were freshly under Homeland Security. They had just... So this was their first exposure to how they would respond to a biochemical type thing. So they totally overblew the response, and our church was panicked. Everybody was either quarantined or under observation. The national organization got involved. And what I realized in this whole process, number one, as the pastor, I'm the one who has a direct line with God. So if anyone dies, it's my responsibility. I brought this group in. And Center for Disease Control is telling me 40 people were exposed. On average, 6 to 8 of those are going to die.
That must be tremendous pressure that you then feel.
Yeah, here I just killed 6 to 8 of my own people because I wasn't in tune with God, you know? And as it unfolded, I watched as the entire organization, you know, we have this belief, God will heal, God's in control, all of this stuff. The reaction all the way from the very top leadership all the way to the newest believer was that they didn't really believe any of that. That they were really panicked. And when it really came down to crunch time, they did not believe what they said they believed. And that was all the way up to the top. And through this, I realized the upper echelon of the organization, most of them didn't believe the stuff that we in the trenches were preaching. And that caused a huge... It turned out it wasn't SARS at all. The woman had allergies. But it exposed this huge weakness in this whole belief system, not just in a church, but all the way from the leadership. I mean, I was talking to the very leadership of the organization. So I kind of had a personal crisis, took a few weeks away, resorted out things, and realized that what I believed as a Pentecostal wasn't true. So then I began to try to change the church and realized you can't really change a church. So in that process... it became obvious that I was going to have to leave the church. I had converted many of the people away from a lot of the traditional Pentecostal doctrines. A couple of families, including my own, did not convert away. So they set it up. It was arranged for me to either be kicked out or resign. I didn't want to fight, so I resigned. Within moments, my wife told me that she also was leaving. And
leaving the church or leaving
you? Leaving me. And I was also vice president of the Chaplains Association in that town. I was vice president of the Ministerial Alliance. So the way it was couched was that I had been presented with an opportunity to defend myself over accusations of having had an affair And rather than defend myself, I resigned, which was totally not true. Nothing was presented. That's the kind of thing you would fight, you know. But so I was instantly convicted without an opportunity to defend myself of adultery, which ends your ministry. So in one day, you know, it was kind of a year and a half process of trying to change the cult, but then I was ousted from the church itself. Now, that's all kind of boring. But where that leaves you is you wake up one day with no family, no friends, no job, no way of making a living, no way of getting hired. And it was a devastating blow to me. I mean, to realize that everything I am is nothing. I mean, you talk about reboot. I mean, you reboot from ground zero. I mean, at 43 years old, having 10 years experience as a pastor, you're still young in the game for the kind of experience, you know, to be restarting your life from nothing at 43. I mean, mm-hmm. I lost everything. You're late in the game. And you know, to some degree, I still feel like it's late in the game for me. But it's a good game, and I'm enjoying playing it.
Well, Rich, it's really powerful kind of stuff that you're talking about. And I think that we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, Chad and I will comment, and we'll ask you some more questions about that. We'll be back at Ask an Atheist. If you'd like to call in for our final third of the show, 253-584-1480. Thank you. Hi, welcome back to Ask an Atheist. Call in show if you'd like to ask Rich, myself, Rebecca, or Chad any questions. We are atheists and we are accepting calls at 253-584-1480. Rich, right before the break, you had told us about sort of that climax of what happened before you actually ended up leaving the church, and then what happened directly after leaving the church. One thing that you had said that really caught my ear was for that little moment where you had that crisis of faith, but you're a pastor, you had felt this motivation to try and change the church. Okay, I know that something's not right. I know that what I've been preaching isn't quite what matches up with reality, and you wanted to sort of see what you could do while staying in that church.
I felt like I had a responsibility. I had brought a lot of those people into that belief, and once I realized it was wrong, I felt like I had a responsibility to correct what I had done. The easy thing to do would have been to cut and run at that point and just say, I'm out. Mm-hmm. But I just couldn't do that, and probably now I probably would do that, because it kind of assumes a bit of arrogance to say, I need to fix it, because you probably can't, or I probably couldn't. But what I tried to do, there were a lot of rules like women can't cut their hair, women have to wear dresses, women can't wear makeup, women can't wear jewelry, men can't wear jewelry, men have to have short hair, no television, no radio. I mean, I could go through the litany. And I began one by one knocking those down and using scripture to do it. And the way Pentecost controls people is people who follow the rules are allowed to do things that people who don't follow the rules aren't allowed to do. And of course, there's threat of hell, too. But the more you follow the rules, the more things you're allowed to do. So the song leader in the church actually was understanding where I was. So she shows up for one service with her hair cut, in jeans, makeup, and jewelry. And
Must have been shocking.
Oh, people were like having a heart attack. And they really had a heart attack when I let her sing, mm-hmm. because that's the pastor, you know, he doesn't let, you know, sinners participate, you know.
There's a similar thing that goes on in Judaism, and I come from Jewish background, very pluralistic. I mean, have had exposure to everything from Hasidic Orthodox to, you know, the most Reconstructionist, but mostly existed in sort of a Reform and Conservative, you know, modern American liberal Jewish substrate. And I, you know, was part of the Temple Youth Group. My brothers and I all had bar and bat mitzvahs. We went through Hebrew school. I was part of Hillel, which is the campus organizations for Jews in college. And really, along that time, I mean, I had very serious thoughts of going into the rabbinate to become a rabbi. And for a while, still in Orthodox Judaism, women are forbidden from right. becoming rabbis, mm-hmm. and from doing things like Torah study and Talmud study in the same way that men are prescribed to do as such. And I mean, I went to Israel in the summer when I was 16, and it was on one of these youth tours. And the hope is that every 16-year-old will go and they'll have an amazing time and they'll feel much more connected to their history and their tradition and their faith, and they'll become, you know, very adamant Jews and raise Jewish families and things like that. And
your switch will flip.
Yeah, your switch will flip or it will solidify. And really what was...
I know who I am.
Exactly. And really what was kind of different for me is, well, I did have an epiphany, except that instead of having that kind of thing, I had a different one. I saw Judaism really much more holistically and in a historical context. We visited really all the old archaeological findings, and I'm like, this is no different from any of the other Mesopotamian pagan religions at this time. And you start looking at exactly what the Hebrew Bible reads. And then I started seeing patterns of subjugation of women in the Orthodox Judaism that I had really been blind to within my own cultural tradition. And I had seen, you know, oh, okay, the Catholic Church, does not allow for birth control, which, you know, keeps women in a less empowered place. And well, in the Pentecostal church, for instance, you know, I always heard of these mythical Christian churches where women always had to wear dresses and could never cut their hair and couldn't go to school and would only be homeschooled and would only have babies. And so as someone that had built as a teen and young adult, as someone who had built their religion and their religious community into their identity so much, I really had this motivation to, I'll take what's good about Judaism and I'll be sort of the face of everything that's good. And, you know, I'll find a good way to practice Judaism despite the things that don't make sense or despite the traditions that are harmful.
Was that met by your peers?
Pretty well, actually, because I existed in a at that point in a pretty liberal, religious community. There, in fact, right now in the Reform and Reconstructionist movements, there are more women going into the rabbinate than there are men.
I also noticed just a few weeks ago, women wrote the first Torah done by women, female scribes. That was done in the Seattle area.
Yeah. And there's a lot more sort of focus on that now. And I think that, from the 60s and 70s, when with just general feminist movement that sort of leaked into, modern progressive Judaism, a lot more egalitarianism within the Jewish, within modern Jewish faith right now. And to be fair, there are some really great rabbis, some that I went to school with, some that are dear friends that, are trying to do this within Judaism and within other religions. But I just found that it was too hard for me to do it authentically, after a period of time.
I noticed this parallel with Rich's story, Becky's story, and actually also mine. And I'm about to say something a little didactic, maybe even arrogant.
Can you explain that word to
me? Yeah, exactly. But, I believe personally that, the reason that the Pentecostal church that you went to, and many other religious environments try to limit that incoming information and make the constituents very different from the world at large is because consciousness of what ethical behavior looks like causes dissonance between that and what you've been taught. And you must, if you are a morally upstanding person in any way, shape, or form, you must go through a phase of trying to make it work.
I like that.
And most of us that are no longer religious went through that phase and were able to see that it doesn't work.
Right.
And now we are the best people we can be by virtue of getting rid of that. That's a strong thing to say, but I believe it to the core. I'd like anybody who'd like to disagree
I absolutely
will spar on that point.
Was hearing that in what Becky was saying, trying to make it work.
Yeah.
Trying to make it work within my understanding of what is right and wrong.
And that guilt, the guilt is a tool, right? And the guilt that you felt when you thought that you had not been in tune enough to God and had killed six people, or the guilt, the guilt is a tool to kind of dull your consciousness of these things. I'm actually getting a little off track. I'm going to stop right now. But it's such a mess. You know what I mean? And what you got to do is just look at what is ethical? That's why I call myself a humanist nowadays, because I'm just like, am I being a jerk to other humans or not?
That's a very valid point. And I think there are probably people listening, especially with the topic of today's program, who are probably in that same place, trying to make it work. I mean, the last thing I ever wanted to be was an atheist. I did not want to be that. But by process of trying to make it work and realizing the harder I tried, the less it worked, it couldn't.
Well, one of the reasons that I really didn't want to be an atheist or claim myself as an atheist, even though I always had a very atypical relationship or concept of God, even for a Jew or for, you know, a person, you know, over a series of years, was because I thought atheists didn't really believe in anything, or they didn't have anything, or they would lose out on the potlucks or the summer camps or the family traditions, or, you know, what does a wedding look like if it's not, you know, in a church or in a synagogue, if you're not, you know, smashing plates and yelling Oppa or stepping on a glass and saying Mazel Tov. What does all that look like?
Hey, you can do it in a bar called the Chapel on Capitol Hill. I'll show you Facebook pictures. Go ahead.
And I think that's really where all these journeys lead us today, is that even though Chad came from Jehovah's Witness background, Rich from Pentecostal, and myself from Judaism, we all end up, you know, now as atheists with incredibly rich lives. Chad, you were getting a little bit distracted at one point. You said you were getting off topic, but I think that something that's really topical is what is life now like for you? And, you know, after faith, what does that living actually look like for you?
Well, life now is amazing, right? My exit was, I was raised a witness throughout my childhood, and it was everything. Many of us can understand, I've always been a little bit melodramatically introspective, taken things maybe way too seriously. So, you know, like you made the decision to not leave, but go back and try to change it because it just wasn't right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Someone's wrong.
Exactly. I spent, you know, probably 6 or 7 or 8 years. As soon as I became conscious and developed some sort of sense of right and wrong, I started struggling to make it work. You know, the first thing that happened was I couldn't, it was a selfish 15-year-old thing. You know, they started discouraging the ideas that I had that I would go on to make some sort of career in music. Categorically bad idea. Strongly discouraged from doing anything. I'm really good at music. It's kind of like I've long felt like it's the only thing I do. That's good. Now I teach life now. I teach guitar for a living. I play in a rock band. Just went on my first tour. Life is amazing. I have no complaints. You know what I mean? Later, that wasn't really the moral thing. That was just kind of more of a dissonance thing. And I gave up on that dream for several years, which is terrible. You know, but in my late teens, you know, sexuality and you know, other things started kind of switching around. And I'm going to skip most of the details. We talked about it on the podcast.
Rich, tell us about the podcast that you have.
Living After Faith, and what it is, it's designed for people who are coming out of faith, regardless of the faith, people who have recently come out, or even if you've been away from faith for some time. And what it does is focuses on the recovery process. The process I went through, Chad has been one of our guests, and I believe it's episode
11.
Episode 11. You can hear the details of his story there. They're all 20 minutes long, perfect for your commute, but you can find it at livingafterfaith.com.
Splendid. So, yeah, life now, I mean, the biggest thing that happened to me is I actually, deconversion-wise, it can be summarized as I prayed and prayed and begged and pleaded and cried and spent years, you know, feeling really screwed up, you know, trying to get God to help me become basically a good person, because I wanted to be a basically good person. I mean, not a spectacular famous person, just a decent human that deserved to be alive. And, you know, never really panned out for me. And I finally, you know, just started doing it myself and growing as a person, and felt betrayed, eventually entertained the idea that maybe there wasn't anybody to be betrayed by now. But yeah, now life is good. No emotional payoff multipliers.
Yeah.
We just look at the situation and we say, who benefits from my actions here if I do this action? You know, who doesn't? You know, we make decisions. I make decisions, you know, based on rational, you know, thought, and I try to do the best I can do for everyone I affect, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
So in my life, you guys,
one of the things you just mentioned is you came to that realization that there wasn't anyone who betrayed you. that to me was the most liberating thing. Now, at first, I felt horrible when I looked in the mirror and said, Rich, you're as low as a human gets. You can't even believe in God anymore. I mean, that's pathetic. You are as low as it gets. Yeah. And then I began to realize, if that's the case, if there is no God, then the cards aren't stacked against me. There's no predetermined will. What I make of situations is what the situations are made of.
Absolutely.
You know, and then I can take control of my life. I don't have to have permission. I don't have to, I can do the things I want to do. And by being empowered in that way, it changes your life. And once that hurdle was kind of over and I began to work on the process of having a good life, life is beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, some of us have hard times when we leave initially. Many of us risk a lot by leaving a religious community. We risk our families. We risk our support network. We risk our jobs. But at the same time, if you know where to look and if you hang on, you know, long enough, you find, you know, great communities. You find, as our caller said, you know, different kinds of hobby groups. Yeah. And some of us actually we transition out kind of gradually, and maybe our families or friends have some mild discomfort about it. My family, I still have, you know, relationships with my family, and nothing that goes on between my family and me is because of any kind of leaving of Judaism. And part of that may be because I still consider myself a Jew. It's a little bit confusing and a little bit nebulous at
more
sometimes.
Of a cultural Jew.
Yeah. Cultural Jew or a humanistic Jew.
Yeah.
And sort of trying to take that cultural tradition and that historical tradition and have it in the light of humanism, where I'm not really God's chosen person and I'm not part of God's chosen people, because if there is no God, he can't choose people. And why would he choose one people over another people? Why wouldn't he just choose people? So
exactly.
I choose people.
Yes, that's the key. But we choose people. We love people.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's Rich and Chad. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Becky, and we are just about out of time. If you would like to continue our conversation, we are going to be meeting up, as we usually do, for some post-show grub. Tonight, we're going to be meeting at Lili Restaurant at 1012 MLK Way in Tacoma. That's at 10th and MLK up in the Hilltop, and we're going to be there at 5 p.m. So if you'd like to ask Rich or Chad or myself any questions, then please do. Please come by. Sam and Mike, two of our producers, will be there as well. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions for later episodes, please go to askanatheist.tv and click the big red button. We also accept voicemails at 206-420-0997. Today, our digital director was Sam Mulvey, our auxiliary was Mike Gillis, and our call screener was Bob Seidensticker. Ask an Atheist is produced by NEDM Media. Please join us next week on KLAY at 3 p.m. and online at askanatheist.tv. Thanks for joining us.
Keeping you informed, this is KLAY, Lakewood, Tacoma.